You could. I can take it. I probably won't grade them until I get a stack of them to grade. So it kind of doesn't matter. So we just saw that the electronics lab's due the 16th. I don't know if people have questions about that or it's good to go. Certain roommates have been eliminated and okay, so today we start kind of a month of working on a different lab, the bubble chamber lab. And this is kind of an introduction to that lab. There are lots of pages written in the manual about this, but it's not an attempt to duplicate this, but kind of give you an introduction to the stuff that's in there. So the lab deals with what is called particle physics or high energy physics, the physics of extremely high energy collisions. And because of quantum mechanics, high energy translates to small, physically small objects. So we're also talking about the smallest units in the universe. So kind of the start is to meet the particles that are going to be of interest. So we've got two different particles that we're going to be dealing with. We've got mesons. And the particular meson that we're going to be interested in is the pi. There are, at this point, literally hundreds of mesons. The claim to fame of mesons is that they are made out of a quark and an antiquark. And since quarks feel the strong nuclear force, pions feel the strong nuclear force. So just as a particle that was made, like an atom that's made out of positive and negatively charged material, feels an electric force, same thing with these mesons. They feel the strong nuclear force. And of course, the pions we'll be dealing with are electrically charged, and therefore they feel the electric force. And the third force in the list is the weak force. And the weak force is actually responsible for the decay of these mesons. And basically what happens is, in the case of a pi plus, for example, which consists of an up quark and an anti-down quark, is these two guys annihilate. And for an instant, we have a particle that's called an intermediate vector boson, or the W. And it is going to then decay into an into a muon and a neutrino. So the upshot then is that if you wait, I don't know, less than a millionth of a second, a pion will spontaneously decay into a muon and a neutrino. Well, muons and neutrinos aren't on our list of particles yet. That's because they're examples of leptons. So examples of leptons would include electrons and the two particles that we've talked about, muons and neutrinos. There's also a particle called the tau that's on the list of leptons. So leptons are a much shorter list of particles. And that's basically because they're fundamental. As far as we can figure out, there's nothing inside of these particles the way there are two quarks inside of a meson. So it turns out if you let a muon sit around for a while, it will spontaneously become a neutrino. And you can see charge doesn't look like it's being conserved in there, because as you might guess, neutrino is going to be electrically neutral. So in this process, what has to happen is we get another one of these intermediate vector bosons, the W being emitted, and then this time that W can decay into an electron, in this case an antimatter electron, a positron, and another neutrino. So since there aren't any quarks inside leptons, they do not feel the strong nuclear force. So things that don't feel the electric force we call electrically neutral, and if they feel the electric force we call them plus or minus charged. So in a similar sort of way, we can think about there being a strong charge, something that's like plus or minus electrical charge, and these leptons simply have zero of that charge. Technically speaking, the name of the charge is actually color. And it's called color for kind of a funny reason, and that is that there's something that is two-dimensional the way color is two-dimensional. Well, what do I mean by color being two-dimensional? Well, you've all seen these color charts that have red, green, blue in the on the sides of the chart and show all intermediate colors. You've never looked at these color charts? Yes, you have. So you can see that you can display all the colors in two dimensions, whereas if you have just one dimension, these aren't all the colors. Right? There are lots of colors missing from that display, right? Like purple, like chartreuse. So color as we experience it as humans, not fundamentally, is kind of a two-dimensional quantity, and so the charge, instead of being a real number the way electric charge is, it's actually kind of two numbers to make something that's fundamentally two-dimensional. So mesons, quarks in particular, have color, and mesons, since they're made out of quarks, feel the color force. Leptons aren't made out of quarks. They have zero color, so-called colorless, and therefore don't feel the strong force. But if they're charged, they'll feel the electric force, and this decay, again, is signs that they feel the weak nuclear force. Okay, so a neutrino is electrically neutral, doesn't have any quarks inside of it, so it only feels the weak force. Well, I use the word only. There's gravity too, right? But gravity is usually so weak in these sorts of experiments that it's negligible. Presumably neutrinos feel the gravitational force also, although it hasn't been directly tested and probably never will be. Okay, so those are the particles we're interested in detecting. The overall decay scheme then is going to be a pion becomes a muon and a neutrino, and then this muon becomes two neutrinos, and in this case an antimatter electron, a positively charged electron that's sometimes called a positron. And I could replace all of those minus signs by plus signs and I'd have an equally good reaction. Okay, so those are the players that are involved in these things. Yeah, so it's not particularly relevant to this experiment, but there's another name that might be worth putting on here, and that's baryon. Baryons are made out of three quarks, and examples would be neutron and proton. So most of the things that you recognize made out of neutrons and protons and electrons, that's what atoms are made out of, are a combination of baryons and a particular lepton. What's special about the electron is it's the lowest mass charged lepton, and so there's nothing for it to decay to. Right? If there wasn't something that had less mass than a muon, this decay would not be possible. So if there were a lower mass charged lepton, presumably the electron would decay just the way the muon does. And kind of no surprise, this tau, it can decay into a muon and actually two neutrinos. Units. So we're going to be dealing with this case with mass and energy and momentum. And you know those all have different units. But it's kind of inconvenient that they have different units. And if we kind of insert some factors of C, they can all have the same units. So when I use the word mass, I really mean mass times the speed of light squared. That would have the units of energy. And if I talk about momentum, I really mean momentum times the speed of light, right? That would be mv squared also. That also has the units of energy. So typically when people are dealing with particle physics, they kind of put in the C's, at least in their mind, and measure all of these things in units of energy. Now, we don't want to measure these in joules, right? Because a particle is going to have a microscopic number of joules. So it's handy to have a small unit to measure these small energies with. And the unit that's mostly used is an electron volt. So an electron volt is the energy that any charged particle, like an electron, would gain when it goes through a potential difference of 1 volt, right? You remember from 200 that the energy is going to be Q times the change in voltage. Okay, so this is sized to the charge of an electron and to kind of normal voltages, so it's a convenient unit. You might remember from modern that the energy levels of the hydrogen atom are kind of scaled to 13.6 electron volts. Well, we want more energy that's in a hydrogen atom, so we'll be typically be dealing with millions of electron volts. And this is actually an old experiment. When I was growing up, we were typically dealing with billions of electron volts. And these days, the biggest colliders produce TeVs, 10 to the 12th electron volts. Okay, so 10 TeVs is, well, it's actually not tuned to that energy level yet, is the biggest current collider in Geneva. And kind of the old biggest collider is at Fermi Lab, and it had 1 TeV beams that collided with each other. Okay, so these particles are typically created by these accelerators where we have big voltage differences that give these particles big energies and big speeds. And then we need to somehow or other measure their properties. And measuring the properties of individual particles is tough. And it took some time to figure out how to do it in a reasonable fashion. And the technology we're dealing with, which is actually kind of old technology, is called the bubble chamber. And as the name suggests, it's going to deal with bubbles. And the first thing I want to convince you with is that it's impossible for bubbles to form, that boiling is impossible. So why is that? Well, you all know that if you try and take water and boil it in Colorado, it boils at a lower temperature. The lower the pressure, the lower the boiling point of water. So actually, if we put water in a vacuum system, it'll boil at room temperature just fine. And it works the other way. You might be familiar with these underwater vents in which we have water that's at like 400 C that's liquid. And that's because it's under huge pressure because it's at the ocean bottom. So the higher the pressure, the higher the melting, or the higher the boiling point, or melting point for that matter. And it turns out that to form a bubble would take, that a small bubble has an infinite pressure that's involved with it, so it would take an infinite temperature in order to cause it to boil. So, I don't know, what's going on there? If you think about a bubble, there's this phenomena called surface tension. And so surface tension is a force, it's a force per length that is acting along the corresponding surface. So if we have vapor, for example, inside of this bubble, and let's talk about water, although the experiment actually has liquid hydrogen, water outside of that bubble, then it turns out that surface tension is going to be producing a huge force trying to collapse this bubble. And so in order for this bubble not to instantly collapse, the pressure here has to be higher than the outside pressure. And it's a simple problem to work out what this pressure difference is. I won't bother to write the formula. The most important thing is that it's inversely proportional to R. So to start to make a bubble from nothing, you have to have R at zero. So you have to have an infinite pressure inside the bubble or it will instantaneously collapse. So you can't have boiling. Okay, so that's why you've never seen anything boil. I love it when students believe everything I say. Well, come on. I mean, we've all made coffee or tea, and we know that it seems to be possible to make boiling. How is that possible? Well, I don't know if you took chemistry, but back when I took chemistry, we used these flasks that are called round bottoms, and they're made out of a single piece of glass, and they're perfectly smooth. And if you tried to boil anything in this round bottom, it wouldn't boil. It would typically explode out the top in one big burst if you heated it too hot. So in order to make stuff boil, normally, you put little bits of rock in the bottom, which are called boiling chips. And if you watch something boil, you would see that the bubbles didn't come from the glass, they all came from the boiling chips. And it wasn't because the boiling chips were hot, right? Everything was at the same temperature. It was some other sort of phenomena. If you look carefully at your pot, your aluminum pan of boiling water, you'll notice that the bubbles don't form just any place. They seem to come from special locations. They don't form any old place. The special locations may change from minute to minute and from use to use, but they seem to be something special about those locations. And what's special is that there are microscopic cracks. And in these boiling chips, there are zillions of sorts of cracks. So under these circumstances, in this flaw, we can make a little bubble without it having to be a sphere, and we can have that bubble grow. But absent some sort of flaw, material can exist well above its normal boiling point. Right? Superheated material. All you have to do is have an absence of flaws. Now, the complicated word for flawed is nuclei. It has nothing to do with the nucleus that's in an atom. I don't know what the origin is of that word. So we need lots of nuclei, flaws of some sort, in order to avoid this problem that it's impossible for things to boil. Well, we can use this fact that boiling just doesn't go in the absence of flaws by using the particle as the flaw. So if we have, and now we might as well talk about the bubble chambers we're talking about, here we have liquid hydrogen. That's above its normal boiling point. So it should boil if there were some flaws, but there aren't any flaws. We've carefully eliminated them. When a charged particle moves through this material, what it's going to do, and we'll talk about the why of this in a second, it's going to leave behind ions, right? Basically what happens is when the charged particle runs into another particle, it'll knock an electron out of the atom, producing a free electron and an ion. And these ions can then be the flaw that allows a macroscopic bubble to form. The ion itself is too small to photograph, but the bubble will grow to a big enough size so that you can take a photograph of it. And so what we have here are bubble chamber photographs which show the track of this otherwise invisible particle by the sequence of bubbles that it leaves behind. Okay. Now, practically speaking, how you use a bubble chamber isn't exactly as I've described. Typically, what you would do is you would put some detectors outside of the bubble chamber that would indicate when something interesting happened inside the bubble chamber. When something happened interesting inside the bubble chamber, you would pull a piston out. So this material normally wouldn't be boiling. If we pull this piston out, now the pressure is lowered so that it should boil if it could boil. Then we'll grow those bubbles for a millisecond. Then we'll take our picture and we'll ram the piston back in, which will collapse those bubbles. Then we're ready to start for another run. So using this technique, you could take 10 pictures a second of interesting events where there would be millions of events that would be literally happening in the bubble chamber. So the name of the game in particle physics is to collect as much data as possible, zillions of bits of data, and literally write it to fast as your disk drive can run, millions of events per second, So we actually need faster things than this these days in order to start fresh, as it were, to do the equivalent of collapsing the bubbles and look for the next event that's going to happen. Okay, so the upshot of the bubble chamber is that we can get the trajectory of the particles by following the bubbles, by following the bread that's left behind, as it were, as the particle moves through the liquid hydrogen. So what can we learn from trajectories? Well, we can kind of put ourselves in the role of cops who are investigating a traffic accident, because we have that same sort of data. We've got kind of the equivalent of the skid marks of our particles, and we can try and figure out what the situations were before and after the collision based on that sort of data. So kind of the first thing, you know, COP 101, is to measure the length of the skid mark that the car has left behind. Right? The longer the skid mark, the faster the car was going. And you know roughly how this works. If we have a skid mark, we have a retarding frictional force, which is mu times the normal force. That force is acting over some distance x, and that work is eating into the kinetic energy. So the change in the kinetic energy, which is equal to the initial kinetic energy because it's going to end up stopped, is just going to be the force times the distance it went. All right, so we can figure out the starting kinetic energy of the car based on how long the skid marks are. So we can do pretty much the same thing with bubble chamber tracks if the particle actually came to rest. And lots of these particles are going to come to rest. We'll have stopping distances. There's really only one important difference between the stopping of charged particles and the stopping of cars, and that's the formula for the force. So here we dealt with a constant force. I suspect you've dealt with things like air drag, where the force is proportional to the velocity squared. Lots of different possible drag forces that we could consider. It turns out that particles work in a really kind of funny way. And that is that the force is proportional to 1 over the velocity squared. So fast moving particles don't feel much of a drag force, but as they slow down, they start to feel a larger and larger drag force. So it's kind of a funny way that it works. So what's going on? Why is there this kind of funny fashion? Well, the evidence, maybe the reason for this drag force, is, you know, the rubber that's on the road. That is to say, the equivalent, the bubbles that are forming. And I really shouldn't say the bubble energy, because the bubble just grows by thermodynamics. It's really the energy that it takes to make the original ion that caused the bubble. So what goes on when a charged particle is going to make an ion? Well, so here's kind of our standard picture of an atom. We've got a nucleus. We got some electrons that are surrounding it. And here comes a muon, a positively charged particle. Or a negatively charged particle, doesn't matter. And what's going to happen is as this muon goes by, there is, since this was a positive charged particle, there's going to be an attractive force between the electron and the muon. That force will, of course, be stronger the closer, this is usually called the impact parameter, the closer the muon is to the atom. But that's not the only thing that's involved, right? The other thing that's involved is the time of the interaction. Because you remember that the impulse that's required depends on the force and the time that the force was present. So for faster moving particles, the force is there, but it's over an instant, and the force isn't strong enough to eject one of those electrons. Whereas if the particle is moving slow enough, the interaction time is long enough to cause enough impulse for the electron to be ejected. So that's why the force gets large kind of unexpectedly for slow-moving particles, because of the longer time of interaction. And there isn't a lot to do. Beta and Block were the first people to analyze the situation. And it turns out it's what I would call not a very hard problem, which is maybe a one-hour lecture to get to the formula that relates what this drag force is to the, just from the electrostatic interaction between the charged particle and the electrons. So the upshot of this is that the change in the kinetic energy of the particle over some microscopic path length is, as I've said, inversely proportional to the velocity squared. And so we're going to be losing kinetic energy every centimeter of path that we go. The slower we're going, the faster we're going to be losing that energy. So let's see what the consequences of that are for the actual stopping distance. Right, so what we need to do is to add up all of these little increments of distance that we got until all of the initial kinetic energy was used up. Does that make sense? So we want to add up, and of course there's a minus sign here, right? Because the kinetic energy is going down all the time. So we need to add up from the initial kinetic energy to zero, because we're going to stop this particle, of all of these little dx's that make up this path. And we can of course get dx by basically substitution. Instead of dealing with path length, let's deal with the kinetic energy, T. So we have dt divided by something that's proportional to minus 1 over v squared. So this is the total path length that we're calculating. And what's helpful, of course, is that kinetic energy goes like velocity squared. So this is proportional to 1 over t. So if we use this minus sign to reverse the order of integration, we've got that. And that's, of course, an integral we can all do. Right? So this is going to be 1 half t squared evaluated from 0 to t naught, which is going to be 1 half t naught squared. So the upshot of all of this is that the square root of the length is proportional to the initial kinetic energy of these particles. So from the length of the skid mark of these muons and pions, we can figure out how much kinetic energy they had when they were created, when they started to turn on the brakes. The exact proportionality constant I haven't worked out, and I think it might be part of the lab to work that out. Okay, questions? So stopping distance is one thing we can use to get a handle on the initial kinetic energy of these particles. Turning radius. So again, the cop can look at turns in the road and figure out how fast you could possibly be going around that corner. Right? So you would know in the case of a car, right, we need some centripetal acceleration, and this force would have to be given by the frictional force, and we could work out some relationship. So how is that going to work for our bubble chamber? Well, our bubble chamber is put in a magnetic field. So there's going to be a force that's going to cause the charged particles to move in circles. And from the radius of that circle, we can figure out information about the motion of the particle. So if the magnetic field, for example, is coming out of this board, and if we have a positively charged particle that's moving this way, then you remember that V cross B, Q V cross B, gives us the formula for the force. Now, you remember the nature of the cross product is that it only cares about the component of the velocity that's perpendicular. So if the particle were moving in the direction of the magnetic field, there'd be no force on it. Right? So actually what we've got here is not the whole velocity, it's only the piece of the velocity that's in the plane of the board. Pieces of velocity that are in or out of the board, those things aren't going to contribute to the cross product and hence not contribute to the force. Okay, so that's what the force is. We know that the acceleration is centripetal acceleration. Can basically cancel out our velocities, and we're going to get then that QRB is equal to MV. And MV is, of course, the momentum. So the upshot of this is if we have a big turning radius, right? So that is to say that it's not turning very much, that particle has to have a lot of momentum, other things being equal. Whereas if it has a tiny turning radius, it must have a little bit of momentum. And in fact, that there's a linear relationship between the radius of curvature of the path and the corresponding momentum. Now, if you wanted to, you could argue with me that relativistic mechanics add some gammas to things and such. And the particles that are making these turns are actually moving a good fraction of the speed of light. So maybe we should be including some gammas. And what I'll just tell you is that if we did this relativistically correct, the momentum that we would have here, which would have a gamma factor in it, is exactly the relativistic momentum. So this equation, which I've derived non-relativistically, is also relativistically correct, assuming that I am talking about the relativistic momentum, which is gamma MV. Okay. So from the radius, we can get the corresponding momentum. Okay, so I've kind of raised the issue of relativistic mechanics. Kind of what do we remember from 320? Well, what I'm fond of saying is that this is the most famous equation, which is wrong. Or if not wrong, it at least needs a lot more explanation. So if this thing is going to be right, the only way I can make this thing be right, well, so what should be perfectly clear is energy is a variable. Right? You can have high energy or low energy, otherwise we couldn't have high energy physics. So if the left-hand side varies, the right-hand side has to vary. And so foolish people think about the mass varying with velocity, and that's nonsense. The mass is a constant that you can write down in books, so this equation really has a gamma in it. And lest you forget, typically in relativistic mechanics, we use the symbol beta to be the velocity divided by the speed of light, and we use the symbol gamma to be 1 over the square root of 1 minus beta squared. So as the velocity approaches the speed of light, beta gets close to 1, we start getting a 0 in the denominator, so the gammas get huge. Right? So betas are limited to between 0 and 1. Gammas range between 1 and infinity as the speed gets a lot closer. But actually, the more important equation is one that usually gets less push, and it's this equation. So we're used to seeing something like that energy is 1/2 mv squared, and this kind of looks nothing like that equation. So one of the reasons this equation doesn't look a lot like that is, of course, by energy I'm including the rest energy, whereas the bottom formula from 191 was just talking about the kinetic energy, the energy you could remove by changing the velocity, not including the rest energy. Whereas the relativistic formula includes all of the energy. So this, of course, results in the fact that as momentum gets big, eventually the energy is about given by PC. Okay. So as the velocity gets very close to 1, this term becomes negligible and the energy is about equal to just PC. And in fact, if you're moving at the speed of light, that's exactly the case. So something like light itself carries energy and momentum in exactly the proportionality that, I put a proportionality sign, but I meant equals. Yeah, so that would be exactly true at beta of 1. And as you get closer and closer to 1, that would be closer and closer to the truth. And the particles we're moving at will be within 1% of the speed of light, so it's a pretty accurate statement for us. Okay, so let's kind of talk about the overall experiment then with this kind of behind us. What we've got is our bubble chamber. And these lines coming in from the left, those are the pions that were created by the accelerator that's downstream. Upstream, I guess I should say. And what's happening is these guys are you can see their curved path because they're charged particles. We're not so much interested in that. They're actually slowing down and they're coming to a rest right here. So here we have a at-rest pion that decays. And it spat out a muon that went that way. It also spat out a neutrino. But you remember neutrinos are electrically neutral, and the way we created ions was by having this electrostatic interaction. So when uncharged particles move through material, they don't leave a trail of ions, and hence are invisible on this bubble chamber. Okay, so what may look like non-conservation of momentum, a particle at rest spits out another particle, there has to be a back-to-back, there has to be a neutrino that's going that way. And simply not leaving a trail of bubbles because it's not charged. So this muon has this stopping distance. It's created at a noticeable speed, but not really a relativistic speed. And it comes to rest there, and it sits there for a microsecond or so, and then it splits into three particles, right? Two neutrinos and an electron. The electron is the one that is charged and hence leaves this trail. If you look at some of these tracks, I don't know, can we find the origin of this one? I don't know where this one originated, but you notice that this one is curling up. That's, of course, because as it loses energy, it's losing momentum, and the smaller the momentum, the smaller the radius of curvature. So for these particles, we're going to be interested in the momentum they had immediately after the decay, not after they've interacted with the material. So we don't want to find the radius of this kind of crazy curve now. We want to find it exactly where it decayed. And I actually can't see where that particle was produced, so I can't use that track. So it looks like here's a pion came to rest, muon went this way, of course, invisible neutrino that way, and here's the electron that was produced. So here there was pion coming to rest, the muon went that distance, and then it spat out an electron that's going that way. Pion, muon, electron. Okay. So if you examine these graphs, the one thing you'll notice, I think, pretty quickly is that L and R are not constant. In that picture, there are short L's and there are long L's. How can that be? In a two-body decay process, the total amount of energy and momentum is fixed, and so there's a definite amount of energy and momentum in the neutrino and in the muon that's created. And according to this, a definite amount of energy should lead to a definite path length. But here we see that there are short path lengths and long path lengths. So why is that?
2D picture.
Yeah, so this is just a 2D picture. And this path length can look short or long, depending upon how it's oriented. Right now it looks long to you, now it looks short. So the distribution that we seem to see in L isn't a fact. Presumably all of these path lengths are the same path length, but just as viewed by the camera, let's imagine the camera is at the ceiling now, it might look short or it might look long. So from this set of data, from this various values of L, we're going to try and extract the actual path length that these things went. The same thing is true for R's, but there's two layers of extra complication. So the first layer is basically the same layer. These electrons may have a velocity that is in part along the direction of towards the camera, and hence in the direction of the magnetic field, and hence doesn't cause any bending. Right? So the decay could occur here with lots of velocity, but most of the velocity is straight up. So the only perpendicular component of velocity is pretty small, so we get a pretty tight spiral. And those paths will pretty quickly leave the bubble chamber, which only has a finite depth. So if you see something that disappears, it's often because that it has left the top or bottom surface of the bubble chamber. The other thing that's going on here is that the muon decay is a three-body decay, right? So in a two-body decay, there's only one way of conserving energy and momentum. In a three-body decay, you can do it lots of ways if you think about it, right? So you can have the three particles going kind of in a Mercedes-Benz symbol, or you could have something like that. There are all sorts of ways you can use to combine momentums and energy and have it add up to the same constant. So the R's really do have, the momenta really are different for the electrons, not just in orientation, but in actual speed. So the problem we've got is we've got a distribution, and by a distribution I mean we don't have one value, we've got lots of values. So from the distribution of L's and R's, we want to extract useful information that will allow us to calculate the masses of the particles that are involved. So how do we deal with distributions? How can we graphically display a range of possibilities? With the relative frequency, right? Well, I claim that you did this in 211, right? Because one kind of standard example of this dealt with the speeds that atoms were moving in a gas, right? The Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. Right, so I hope you remember, right? There was some sort of bell-shaped curve that indicated that some of the atoms were moving fast and some of the atoms were moving slow. And you had a nice easy formula for the RMS value of the velocity, which wasn't the peak and wasn't the average. Was nicely related to 3kT. Confusion? Memory? Memory lapses? Dementia? I don't know. So what is graphed in the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, right? So this is the velocity. What's this? What's the y-axis?
Isn't it like a proportion? Like how many were given velocity?
So how many of the atoms in this room have a velocity that's pi? What do you think? So let me first get a definite answer to my question. How many, there are zillions of atoms in this room. How many of them have the velocity that is pi meters a second? When somebody asks you a question like that without a calculator, there are kind of only two possible, well, there are three possible answers usually, right? Zero, one, or infinity.
Zero.
Yeah, zero, right? Because if it had a velocity that was exactly pi, it would have to match an infinite number of digits. And we think about pi as being a particular real number, but any real number is like that. It has an infinite number of digits. So you pick any real number, and the probability that an atom has that speed is zero. But it has to be kind of like that. I mean, you know that what this diagram is showing you is that there are lots of atoms that have this speed, but I can't mean that literally because no atom has that speed. So how do we deal with this? I don't know, it's kind of tough, and I suspect that it was kind of glossed over in 2.11 because it's kind of tough. So let me suggest something that's, I think, a little bit easier to understand, and from that, we can figure out what's going on here. So if you think about it, what I think is a perfectly well-defined quantity that's not 0, 1, or infinity, that is the following. The fraction of atoms that have a speed less than, say, pi. Right. So the cumulative fraction function, that expresses the fraction of the distribution. I'll call them atoms, but it'll depend on what we're measuring. That have a, I'll call it speed, but it could be any property, less than or equal to x. So that's what I'll mean by the cumulative fraction function f of x. So f of 0 is 0, and f of the speed of light is 1. And this curve has to be kind of like that, right? It has to go between 0 and 1 smoothly. If I add more velocity, I have to add more fraction. Does that make sense? Maybe, maybe not. It's kind of funny that I think that this is the thing that you're most familiar with seeing, right? Like distribution of scores on SATs. But it's actually hard to understand. This is, I think, easier to understand, but I'd be really surprised if you ever saw that before. So what's the relationship between these two? Well, it's a derivative relationship. Where the slope is big, that's the speed at which we're gaining more and more molecules per meter per second. Where the slope is zero, that's where there are hardly any molecules. And so right here where we have the biggest possible value, that's where we have the biggest possible slope. So kind of a generic name for these things are histograms. And these are cumulative fraction functions, and we've got the derivative. Well, we can't actually literally take a derivative, right, with real numbers, right? It's kind of something they can do downstairs, but not up here. So really what we're going to mean when we're talking about the derivative is we're going to take the fraction at x, and we're going to subtract the fraction of x plus delta x, and we're going to divide it by delta x. And we're not going to let delta x go to zero because that would lead to, I mean, we can't really do it, right? They can do it downstairs, but not actually do it in real life. So we call this delta x the bin size. And if you think about what this is, f of x is the fraction that are less than the right-hand corner of the bin, and f of x plus delta x is the fraction that's everywhere to the left of the left, the right of the left-hand side of the bin. So if I take the difference, that's the fraction of the molecules that are in that range delta x. And then I divide by the bin size. Okay. So practically speaking, histograms really require you to have thousands of data points in order to do them at all accurately. And you guys get tired of measuring things sometime well before 1,000. So that's another reason to use cumulative fraction functions. So you can make a reasonably accurate cumulative fraction function with 100 data points. And that's the sort of thing that you can actually, you will actually measure. I think you'll measure 66 of these things or something like that. Okay, so the cumulative fraction function is something that allows us to get a handle on the distribution of these values. How do we extract things from that distribution? Right? So in the case of these path lengths, we're going to measure all sorts of these path lengths depending upon the random orientation of these decays. And what we'd like to get out of that is the actual path length that the particle went through. And of course, one way you could do that would be by just looking at the maximum, right? Measure 100 of these things. If the particle is in the direction of the camera, it's going to be short. If it's perpendicular, it's going to be as long. And if you kind of look at the maximum, you're probably going to get close to the biggest possible value. So there are good reasons not to do that. So one good reason not to do that is it's going to reduce 100 data points down to just one in an instant, right? So that seems like a real waste of effort. Measure 100 things and only get one number out at the end. Probably a more significant problem is misidentification. Almost for sure, you will make some mistakes in measuring this 100 values. And if you make a mistake and it happens, it's not unlikely then to be unusual, like the longest one, you're going to throw off your entire experiment. So while the maximum maybe is not a, and it's a terrible way of doing it, but a three-year-old might believe it, that that's a reasonable way of doing it. So we'd like to come up with a slightly better way of doing it. So one way we could do it would be by looking at the average value. So you remember that for the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, actually the RMS value, not the average value, but one number kind of characterized the whole distribution. And if you knew the RMS value, you knew the temperature, you knew everything about the distribution. So in a similar sort of way, the average value might be one sort of approach. So let's take a look at what that means. And in order to do this in a limited amount of time, it's helpful to have a toy model. So the real experiment, the one that you're actually doing and the one you actually have to calculate, is different from the one I'm going to talk about. The one you have to do is actually a decay in three dimensions. But that leads to kind of unnecessary complications on the board. Let's deal with a simpler problem where the decay has to be in the plane of the board. You know, so you could kind of imagine flipping this thing around and having it spin around, a wheel of fortune sort of thing, and then it comes to rest, and then we would measure what the camera would see as the actual path length. So in this toy model, right, theta is a random number, and we're going to generate lots of perpendicular distances. And we like to try and figure out what the average value is, what the distribution is, what's going to be common, all that sort of stuff. Again, given that the camera is on the ceiling. So let's start with the cumulative fraction function, even though it's kind of the hard one. I don't know if it's hard or not. So if I pick some particular angle, so let's say I pick 32 degrees, what fraction of the paths do we expect to be smaller than whatever 32 degrees would give us? Right, which would be the sine of 32 degrees times L. So a random collection of these paths, what fraction of them would be shorter than the distance that would be generated by 32 degrees? Yeah, right. The ones that would be short would have to be ones that were in this location, or this location, or this location, or this location. But those are all duplicates. So basically, we only have to consider 90 degrees. So the fraction should be the angle that we're talking about divided by 90 degrees, which is pi over 2. So this would be the fraction. Now, what's wrong about this perfectly correct formula, what's not helpful about this formula is we don't actually measure theta, right? What we measure is L perp. So can we find a formula for this angle theta in terms of what we measure actually L perp? What's the formula?
L perp sine theta, would you solve for?
Yep. So L perp is L sine theta. So theta is the inverse sine of L perp over L. So the cumulative fraction function is going to be 1 over pi over 2 times the inverse sine of x divided by L. Right, inverse sine is a function that starts at 0 and goes up to pi over 2. So if we were to graph this cumulative fraction function, when x equals L, because the inverse sine of 1 is 90 degrees, this thing would be all set. And of course, cumulative fraction can't be anything shorter than 0, so f of 0 is 0. I know, so I hope this is looking a little bit hopeful to you, because this is a function that has a parameter in it that could be adjusted until it fit the data. Right, so we can take our 100 data points and we can calculate the fraction that are less than any old number. So we can get our data points, and the book describes how to get the error bars for those data points. But you know, for one of these data points, this would be the number of data points that are smaller than it divided by the total number, actually plus one for obscure reasons. So we can get our data, and we can put in this function, and we can ask the computer to adjust L until it gives us the best possible value. So this is a way that uses all of the data points, and if we made a mismeasurement, it'll probably be fairly obvious because the curve won't fit. And we get the parameter out by least squares fitting, which is our favorite way of getting parameters. It's not a usual sort of function, right? It's not a linear function or a power law function, but it's a perfectly good function. And so we can use least squares fitting in order to get that, to extract that parameter. So how about the average? So from this relationship, I hope it's clear that the average value, and usually we use angular brackets to describe average value, the average value depends on the actual distance times the average value of sine of theta. Now that might worry you a little bit, because I hope usually you think that the average value of sine of theta is zero. But we're not talking about the full average, we're just talking about the average out to 90 degrees, right, out to pi over 2. And sine is positive throughout that region, so the average value of sine is certainly some definite number. Well, when you're dealing with averages, usually add up numbers and divide by the number. What does it mean to take the average of a function? So usually we would say that the average value of x, where in the notation I'm using today, angular brackets, we would add up the list of values and we divide by the number of data points that we have. But now we're talking about the average of functions.
Don't you multiply something by the integral or something like that?
Yeah. So the integral has to be involved because the integral, you know, I hope, that the symbol for integral comes from sum, right? The integrals are kind of versions of sums, Riemann sums, although Newton is the guy who invented the symbols and the integral. So there ought to be some relationship between the integral and the sum. And we can kind of get a handle on that by bringing back Riemann summation, right? So if we have some function and we add up all of the values of that function, we're going to get something very close to the integral. Except we needed a little delta x here. And that delta x was this bin size, right? The range of variation divided by n. So if I put that in and kind of rearrange things, I've got 1 over n times the sum of these function values. That's going to be 1 over the range of integration times the integral of f of x dx. So what we mean then by the average of sine is over the range of integration, which is from 0 to pi, integrate the sine of theta d theta, and then divide it by the range of integration, which is pi over 2 minus 0, or just pi over 2. So we all know the antiderivative of sine is negative cosine. So we got negative cosine of pi over 2 minus the cosine of 0. And so that's going to give us cosine of pi is 1. So the upshot is that the average is a fraction 2 over pi times L. So once again, if we've measured the average value, and we can do that just by adding up the 100 path lengths that we've measured, and we can divide that by 2 over pi, and we can get what the actual length is. Once again, if we've made an error, it's probably going to affect the average a little bit, but not nearly as much as it would if we made the error with the maximum method. So these cumulative fraction functions are ways we can extract parameters from distributions. Okay, and we're going to do that for both L's and R's. So everything I did here had to do with two dimensions. You're actually going to be concerned with things in three dimensions. So none of these formulas are going to be the formulas you're actually going to use. Well, I don't know, you might have been getting worried when I talked about measuring 1,000 data points or even 100 data points. How are we going to do that in a way that that isn't objectionable? And to do that, we need to go downstairs and take a look at the computer. So let's go head down to the actual chemical room. That's where the computer that we're going to be using is. No, we'll never. We'll come back here in a month. So probably you want to take your stuff with you. Where's a nice room? You could come back. So my guess is that some of you, but not most of you, have used these Linux computers. Who has not used these Linux computers? Okay, you're our guinea pig. So the plan is to log in. You didn't know you had an account, but you're supposed to have an account.
Okay.
So your account is, I think so it's not your Windows account. This is a totally different computer system. But start out with your Windows username, and then for the password, use the last four digits of your ID, and then the first four letters of your username. One more time. Let me watch it this time. So username is, how many letters are in there? 259. That might be one letter too many, but let's try it one more time. And now password, last four digits of your ID, four letters of your username. So like for me, this is...
Giving me failure again.
Yeah, well, we'll get it to work eventually. So if it doesn't work, you should probably email me. But again, so for K-Test, K-T-E-S-T, then it's going to be 2041 K-T-E-S. For Clayton Gerhart, who has too many letters in his name, then it's truncated at 8 letters. Okay, so somebody who thinks they can log in on over there. So this is, again, Unix login. Okay, so what we see here is a bubble chamber photograph and a digitizer, and we have a program that allows us to more or less automatically measure these lengths just by clicking buttons. So the name of this program is Bubble.
Yeah, I did this this summer.
Okay, oh, that's right, okay. So, do we want to get rid of your files or not? Probably not. Okay. So we need another guinea. Actually, we could make a subdirectory and do it in there, I think. Okay. So here's a little path length. There's a path length. This little guy is a path length. We're interested in measuring those. And if you read that, and it's also in the notebook, what it says is that for lengths, you're going to hit the zero button at the beginning and end of the path. So for real, you'd probably want to tape this down a little bit, but I won't bother. So I'm going to hit zero button at the beginning and zero button on the end, and it's going to say L is equal to some number. Then I'm going to do this one, And I can do this one, it should be noticeably shorter than the other ones. And so it goes. So not uncommonly you'll make a mistake, and if you read what it says, there are ways of deleting those mistakes. As good a way as any is just to notice the number of the mistake, and at the end of the program it'll ask you if you want to delete anything by number. 3 points determine a circle, so if I hit the one button on a piece of a circle and do 3 points that are, you know, not super close but not super far, you know, maybe 30 degrees apart, then I can get the radius of that circle. And again, these things coming in are not what we care about. We're looking for things that have their origin in one of these decays. Here's one. So there's a piece of a circle, and if I hit the number one button, cover enough of a circle so that it doesn't look like a straight line to the computer, I get what the radius is. And this isn't an appropriate one, but here it's a tighter circle, so I can take my points closer together and get a radius. Okay, so data collection should go reasonably fast to get the 60 or so data points that you need for both L and R. There's another potential problem that's historically of interest. Maybe I left it upstairs. So there are typically about 3 data points per picture. So you're gonna go through a big pile of these pictures. What happens if you're not doing a good job? How can you know whether you're accurately measuring the beginning and end of paths? So what I have here is a made-up bubble chamber, where all of the paths are 1 centimeter long and all of the circles are 20 centimeters long. So we can calibrate our ability to do it accurately, and there are crosshairs. I'm not sure I'll try and do it super accurately, but I hope that these are close to one, because I'm being lazy, but maybe not particularly lazy. Yeah, pretty close. And all of these circles are supposed to be 20s. So we can calibrate our ability to measure things with this digitizer. I hear laughing. So I missed by a mile, or?
How does that thing work?
It works electromagnetically. There's a pickup coil here, and you probably can't see it, but there's a light that comes on when it's not in proximity, where it doesn't know where this thing is. So if I bring this thing in contact, that light goes out, so it now knows where this thing is. And those coordinates are transmitted to the computer and calculations are made. Okay. So you're going to collect data, you're going to analyze the data. The result is going to be the mass of the muon calculated 2 different ways, once based on the averages. You remember you can get things from averages, and the other way based on a fit to the cumulative fraction function, which will be the cumulative fraction function for 3-dimensional decays. And then you're going to get the mass of the pion and the mass of 2 different ways, once based on averages and once based on cumulative fraction functions. So the R's give us the muon mass, and the path lengths give us the pion mass. And I can't emphasize enough, because usually somebody makes this mistake and then you have to redo the whole experiment. These things coming in from the left are not the circles that we care about. Right? So at least as a first approximation, only take circles that originate on segments that you can see are muon paths. I don't actually see any there that I like. Right? So this is something we don't care about. This is a length that we care about. And here's a circle that we care about. They don't have to be correlated. That is to say, you don't actually have to, if you take a path length, if you see a path length that you can't see the circle for, you know, that's okay, you could still take that data. In an unlikely event where you can see a circle but not a length, you could still take that data. They don't have to be correlated, but certainly it's a good start to just take correlated points. Okay. Maybe one final comment from looking at these pictures. If you look at these pictures, you notice that these lines are thick And this electron line is very thin. The electron is the one that's moving relativistically, close to the speed of light. And you remember that the force gets small for those high velocity particles because relatively few ions are created. And if few ions are created, we're not going to get a very thick bubble path. So the thick paths come from relatively slow moving particles, and these thin paths come from particles that are moving very fast. Okay, good to go.
Where did you want to start from the first slide?
I think it's the. I think it.